The riskiest thing is like being too scared to take the next step when it's presented to you and you know this is what you need to do. And whether it's whatever, like, if you want to be a photographer or something, you don't need to risk that much to build a portfolio to try it. You know, you can start with your phone and or, you know, have a part-time job or whatever and buy a camera, go take photos for free. That's not you. You know, you're risking a little bit of your time, but if you're really into it and you're excited about it, that's fine.
That was Chris Ruggiero, and this is episode 39 of the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. I have always been interested in risk, randomness, and uncertainty. It's a thread that runs through my career where I work professionally in risk and also my life. And I think it runs through all of our lives. The podcast, the All Things Risk podcast, is my excuse to have some great conversations with interesting people. I use the lenses of risk, resilience, and randomness to cover all kinds of topics. It's a side project for me. I'm a Canadian based in London. I work in a corporate environment. I spend my free time doing lots of things. One of those things, of course, is the All Things Risk podcast. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for sharing the show, for leaving reviews and feedback. Feedback in particular is wonderful stuff. So if you have any, allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to leave that. I'm working on making the show better and better. And I also find myself learning from my guests, which is great. And I hope that you are as well. Hope 2017 is treating you well. And I hope that the winter is also treating you well if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. Happy Lunar New Year to those of you, the Year of the Rooster, for everyone who is celebrating that or has celebrated that. A happy new year. Let's get on to my guest. Today, I'm speaking with Chris Ruggiero. Chris is an entertainer, an author, a podcaster. He's based in Los Angeles in the United States, of course. He does something called the One Man Variety Show, which is a traveling show where he does juggling, plays with fire, throws knives, does all kinds of things along those lines. He's traveled all over the United States. He's appeared on the Ellen DeGeneres Show. And that's, if you're American, of course, you know what that is. If you're not, it's a very popular show in the United States. He's got a book called Just Go, Adventures of a Traveling Entertainer and a Guide to Living Your Dream. And I've always been fascinated by people who seem to know and have always known what they want to do with their lives, particularly because I don't think I fit that mold, but Chris fits that very well. And we do have an interesting conversation. We talk about performing and connecting with an audience, honing your craft, risk and risk-taking. And this takes a page from his book called Just Go. It borrows on a number of the themes, or the conversation touches on a number of the themes that we've had in and around the show previously. We talk about entertainment and fame in the digital era. We talk about success. And we do have a moment. I mentioned Tom Brady as someone who's really interesting. If you don't know who Tom Brady is, and by the way, for my American listeners, there are people outside the US who do not know who Tom Brady is. This episode was recorded back in, I think, at the end of November, and it's going out the day after the Super Bowl. I'm based in London, the United Kingdom, and it's always difficult to watch the Super Bowl. I enjoy American football, and obviously the Super Bowl is the biggest game of the year. The kickoff is at 11:30 p.m. our time, so last night I watched right up until the middle of the second quarter when Atlanta was leading 21-0, and I decided, right, I need to go to bed now. At least this year, the outcome isn't in doubt. And then obviously I woke up this morning and found out that that Tom Brady, who is quite clearly the best player to have ever played in that sport, led the greatest comeback in the history of the Super Bowl. And you know, bring it back to the themes of the show, probabilities and uncertainty. And you know, I don't think that's entirely an accident. At any rate, a little bit of digression. But we do have an interesting conversation, Chris and I. And I do want to say that for some reason, I felt that even though it was a very good conversation, this one took a little while to warm up. And I don't always know why. I think one of the reasons is whenever I'm speaking to someone remotely, it does take a little bit of time for the conversation to kind of get going into a variety of places. And I think that's common. But we do get into some interesting things in the end and covered a lot of fun ground. So without any further delay, let's go meet Chris Ruggiero. Enjoy. So, Chris, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, I'm excited to have a chat.
Perfect. So, I was just telling you, I don't go ahead with a whole set of pre-programmed questions. But now for, I think, the last 10 or so episodes, I have been asking my guest the same opening question, which seems to be working. And that question is, when you're asked what it is you do, how do you answer that?
The best thing to give people a visual of what I do is I'm a professional juggler and theater variety entertainer, which could be kind of confusing for some people. But basically, I have a circusy variety show. But instead of having a full cast of characters in the circus, I do all of the things myself. So the name of my show is The One Man Variety Show. And then through my variety show, that led to a lot of other little branch-off things, like I host a podcast as well. I wrote a book about my travels around the world and people I've met and kind of lessons that I've learned. And it's kind of always evolving into, you know, now making videos. And it's kind of branched off into this whole, all these little pieces of the puzzle that all come together to be part of my touring variety juggling show.
Oh, very cool. So that was a nice, good, solid 2 minutes worth of answer, which is great because, go after people who kind of either struggle to answer that question or spend, a lot of time talking about your various angles that answer can go. So I think we got a lot of good stuff that we can dive into there. So juggling and variety show, is that something that you always wanted to do, or how'd you get into all of that?
Yeah, I started I learned how to juggle when I was a little kid from my dad. He wasn't a professional performer or anything, but he was just like a hobby juggler, unicycler guy. Like he did it for fun. So there were juggling things around the house. There was a unicycle. So as a little kid, I was curious, so I picked it up and started learning it. And then I was actually really shy as a little kid, so I could never really imagine myself getting up on stage and talking, let alone like juggling and doing something like a skilled thing in front of people. But it kind of evolved, and I kind of like opened up a little bit to be more willing to be out in front of people. And then when I was in college, I was performing, and I went to school at Penn State University, and they had a juggling and magic clubs there. And I was like, oh, there's other people who are into this weird circusy stuff. And we started creating shows and variety shows, performing around. And we realized that there was parties that were like, yeah, we are willing to pay you to come perform for our guests. And we were like, wow, this is amazing. We're just like doing this for fun. And now people are willing to pay to bring us into their parties. And then from that, I kind of established and developed my own show, and then branched off into bigger shows. And now now I kind of perform at a lot of private events. And it's really cool. The evolution of it was pretty organic. I start small and like little things and kind of figure things out. And then as they get bigger, you get bigger things. And kind of the same way everything has to happen, just starting from being interested in something and then kind of realizing maybe by accident that it could possibly work as a job.
Very cool. And so is it just kind of like juggling, juggling with fire? I saw some of your videos. You sort of juggle things with fire, and you stand on a ball and unicycles. Is that the kind of stuff that you do?
Yeah, so I try to keep it a little bit interesting, you know, because people have an image when you say juggling that is kind of cheesy and generic or like really kids entertainment. And while all my stuff is family friendly and kid appropriate, I try to keep it a little bit, you know, maybe hip or cool might be the word, which those words aren't very hip or cool, I guess, but you know, just to keep it a little bit more interesting, so like not so cheesy, generic, like the bad juggling type thing that sometimes
like the
people
stuff
imagine.
You've seen growing up, and that you see it at every sort of garden variety. Like every city has got a little, you know, has got a magician or a juggler in that does kids' parties, kind of a thing.
Yeah, so I try to keep it fresh. You know, I have high energy music, and and then I try to keep it fresh with the material too. You know, since it's not just me like doing a cheesy juggling thing, I try to combine things. Like I stand on top of a ball, I juggle fire, I do knives, just like kind of all different types of things. And then the biggest part of my show is getting the audience involved, and I interact with the audience and get to hang out with them a lot too.
Cool, very very good. Well, you mentioned there that you've kind of traveled all over doing this sort of stuff. And is this the kind of thing that you, it sounds to me, I guess I'm putting words in your mouth, but it sounds, given your first, you know, the first answer to my question, that it wasn't necessarily something that you had envisioned that you would be doing, but I'd be curious to understand that kind of path. I mean, if you were to sort of draw a blank piece of paper, I don't know, when you're growing up, would you say, well, I wanted to be a juggler, or I always wanted to be a juggler, or, you know, a variety show, you know, the things that you do, how do you explain where you are today?
Yeah, and I think the best way to answer that is I see juggling and variety show and stuff as a tool that I can use. So I was always interested and involved in live entertainment growing up through elementary school into middle school into high school. I was playing music. Mm-hmm. I was a drummer, so I was in bands, and so I was on stage and interacting with audiences, and I loved that thing of live entertainment. Like I just loved live entertainment. I loved going to see live shows, and then I loved performing them. So that, you know, at that point, that was my tool. You know, I was playing drums to entertain people, and then it kind of just evolved slow. Like I'm not sure how, just like kind of naturally evolved where I was became more interested in the juggling stuff, and you know, the music stuff I'm still interested in, but that has kind of faded away a little bit. So that was the thing. It was just kind of like, I think those things, and I don't know what I will, you know, there's some jugglers who are like jugglers and they like, that's their life. And they you know, they practice for 4 hours a day and like, they're always going to be a juggler.
Right.
Where like, if something like, I obviously love juggling and I've gotten good at it because I've been interested in it and I've practiced a lot. But like, if there was a different tool that allowed me to connect with my audiences in a better way, like I'm starting to add a little bit of a message into my shows and be more of a presentation, like a speaking type thing. So like, if that is where my toolbox evolves, where I'm, you know, where I can connect with an audience just through speaking, I don't need to juggle.
Okay.
So that's a kind of a roundabout way to answer your question.
Yeah, no, that's, but I think it's really interesting. A few things that you touched on there are really interesting, and I want to get into a couple of them. One of them is really just, I'm not an entertainer, so I don't really know much about what goes into it, but I, you know, do this podcast, and in my professional life, I, you know, give loads of presentations and things like that. But what could we talk a little bit about connecting with an audience when you do live shows, and maybe how you do that, how you feel like it's going well or it's not? We talk a little bit about
that? that's an interesting one, because I think that separates what an amateur and a professional is. You know, an amateur focuses on what they're doing, you know, the making sure they're not messing up or whatever it is, you know, not dropping the juggling things or not hitting the wrong note if you're a singer or a musician.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it's the only thing that I can speak of is as I've gotten, I think, better at connecting with audiences, I care less about the technical things. And maybe that's because I'm technically getting better, so I don't have to think about it as much.
Yeah.
But I think that's maybe not completely true. Maybe more so is that I can go up on stage and drop juggling things, like because I drop something pretty much every show. I've probably never had a show where I didn't drop something or fumble with something or it never goes exactly how I want it to. And I think at the beginning that freaks people out, and then on stage they are like oh, like you see their face cringe up, and then the audience's face cringes up because they're like, oh, I feel bad for that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Now
mm-hmm.
Where now I'm like, cool, I just dropped that and I'm going to make it look cool when I pick it up, you know, because I'm just going to go with it. And like, there's times when sometimes I'll like kick it up with my foot or something, and then that gets an applause. They're like, whoa, that was like a trick. And it like looked like it was part of it.
Right.
So connecting with the audience is more about connecting with the audience than it is doing whatever you're doing to connect with the audience. And any person that we see as that, you know, a celebrity or something, we don't like them because of the thing that they do.
Hmm.
We like them because of who they are. I'm trying to think of an example. You know, it's anything, you know, think of a rock star as an easier image because that's more universally. You know, most people don't have like a favorite circus artist, but people have a favorite rock star.
Sure.
It's typically not because they can hit a higher note or because they're like they have a range of 4 octaves or whatever. You know, it's because they like are a personality that people connect with.
Mm-hmm.
So connecting with an audience, no matter what it is, I think is more about just that. Like, and I can come out and just be in my mindset, be like high energy and be like, yeah, let's have fun. And then it kind of doesn't mean, as long as the outline of the show is there, people are going to care way more about what, like how I interact with them than like the juggling. It's like, it's kind of, I tell people it's like kind of a, I hope that no one ever comes up to me after my show and is like, wow, you were the best juggler I've ever seen.
Right.
I hope they never say that. I hope they say, wow, you were funny, or you were entertaining, or you were, you know, it's some other thing than the juggling, because that's not what I care about. It goes back to what we talked about earlier about using that as a tool. Those juggling clubs are just a tool for me, and that's how I can connect with an audience right now.
I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in there. And, you know, we're all, in some ways, you know, there are very few jobs where you don't have to connect with, you know, a customer, a group of people, a team, you know, whatever. And I think there's probably something there that is transferable. I mean, I think one of the pieces of advice that people give you when you're doing a presentation is, you know, the people in the audience want you to succeed, right? They don't want it to bomb. They don't want it to be boring. They, you know, they want you to, you know, to do well. And if you, you know, start with that vantage point and you kind of screw up a slide or you know, don't quite articulate something well, you just, you know, acknowledge it and move on. And if there's a bit of a human connection, then that can help you. But it's a skill, right? That takes some cultivating, I imagine.
Yeah, and I'll to relate it back to something that might be relevant to more listeners. When I roll out there, I've done shows for, you know, thousands of people in the audience,
mm-hmm.
and I've done shows for, you know, 8 people in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes going into the show, I don't know what it's going to be. You know, I perform at universities and colleges a lot throughout the U.S. And I can show up at, you know, it's just like a one night. I show up one night, the students come out and see the show. I could show up and I'm in their theater and like, you know, 1,200 kids could come out. Or I could show up and they're like, oh, yeah, we're not expecting too many people. So we're going to put you in the coffee shop on campus and it's full of like kids, students studying for the midterms,
right.
and the coffee grinder is going throughout the show. And so going back to what people, you know, whether you are customer service, or you're working with a team at your job, like, you have to go about, when you interact with those people, say, whatever your audience is, mm-hmm. as in whatever the people that you're interacting with that day, coworkers or customers or bosses, whatever it is, mm-hmm. you need to adapt what you do. Like, I have a way that I act when I walk out on stage and there's 800 people in the audience. And that's not going to work when I roll out in the coffee shop and people are studying for their midterms. Like, I need to be a little, I can be larger than life, rock star vibe, in the big room. But if I go out in the coffee shop and act like that, people are like, who does this guy think he is? Like, I need to turn it down where then I can just roll up, in the coffee shop. It's more like me hanging out in someone's living room. Like, my voice tone needs to change. My body language needs to change, because I need them to not see me as this disconnected person up there on stage. I need to see them as, like, we're just in a, in a living room hanging out, and I'm going to show you some tricks and hang out with you guys for a few minutes. So going back, I know I keep going back into that, but that's the what I wanted to say with that is, there's different people. Every single person that you interact with is expecting, and they're used to, that, like, they have their own personality and how they like to be treated and
sure. Yeah.
how they respond to different things. And, it's important to be mindful of that, at least acknowledge that different people, Larry Binet, some of the listeners will know him, Larry Binet. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He does the connections. He's really involved with connecting people and stuff. And he talks okay. about it in, like, the most basic level. He was like, figure out, like, some people hate when you call them on a telephone. Like, if you just keep saying, oh, I'm going to keep calling this person because I want to keep up with them or whatever. Like, your best intentions are there to keep in touch with somebody. Right. But if they hate answering the phone, you're like, that's never going to be beneficial for anyone. Mm. But, like, what they love, it's way easier for them to respond to a text message. So, like, you can't say, well, I like talking on the phone, so I'm going to keep calling this person.
Yeah.
And that's, like, the most basic level of it. But figure out what works for other people and their personality types and their, just how they operate and right. work for them. You're typically not doing very many things in whatever business you are for yourself.
Right.
You're pretty much working in a team or with customers or with a boss or however it is. No one is out there working alone.
Yeah.
I was trying to think, is there anything that you do that you're just completely alone? And no, I don't think there's anything.
Yeah, no one's an island. Now, there's a lot of good stuff in there about uncertainty. It's just sort of the way my mind works. But I guess you're going on the road, you're doing shows, you're never quite sure. You probably, if you're on the road a lot, I presume you are, then you're going to show up at a venue that you may have never, done a show at. So you're not quite sure what it's like or what the vibe is or anything like that. And I guess you have to kind of figure it out and adjust. Was there?
Yeah. It's always, almost all my shows are at a place that I've never been before. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So totally.
Have you ever had any, really, really bad experiences where it's like, oh crap, that crowd was a little tough, or, that didn't go well or anything like that?
Yeah, totally. So one of my, all the time, it's very rare for a show to be exactly perfect in every way and go how I want it to be. Yeah. And, the sound system to not be wacky the microphone to cut out in the middle of the show, or something always happens. But going back, I know your theme here is, risks and all that, maybe even in the thing of, like, getting out of your comfort zone is, like, goes back again. I think it all keeps cycling back to that. It's like, it doesn't matter. Like, none of those little things matter. If you get up there and have a good time or do what, what my job is to do isn't to juggle. It's to give people, like, a half hour or an hour to kind of escape their day and just kind of let loose and have fun.
Sure.
And, I've had shows. It's interesting. I've done shows at, like, engineering schools.
Okay.
And, or even, like, an engineering conference.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certain minds that think like engineering minds, and they're always like, because I do juggling and I do some magic tricks, and those those people are often less interested in like having fun and and just enjoying the show.
Right, they want to break down what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're like analyzing yeah. this, especially in the magic yeah. tricks. They're like looking and they're like, and you can just feel it. They're like, well, they're like figuring it out yeah, as you do it. Yeah. So that's been the, not to, I don't want to isolate my my audiences no, here in the shows that I've done, but I think it's fairly like you could see that, how that could be, you know, these certain audiences, and you're just like, I did one and it was like a conference and it was like all engineers, and you just see they're just like watching me like the whole time.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's not like it wasn't a disaster or anything. It just wasn't as, you know, it wasn't quite as,
it's a different vibe, you know, right? Yeah. It's a different vibe.
Yeah. Like then if I do like a youth group show or something and yeah. there's 1200, 14 year olds and they're just like going nuts the whole yeah. time. Like yeah. it's a whole different world.
Yeah. The world needs engineers, but I can see how they would look at a magic show entirely differently.
Yeah, like they might not be the best target audience of like a full audience of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, very yeah. That's just interesting. What are some of the places where you've traveled to do your shows? What are some of the more interesting places that you've been?
Yeah, I've been all over the U.S. Back and forth for mm-hmm. going on about 7 years now of doing my show. So I've been all over the U.S., mostly at colleges and universities, and now it's becoming more private events, corporate events, mm-hmm. Like end of the year holiday parties are big right now for corporate things, depending when people listening to this, maybe.
Yeah, it'll be, I'm guessing, around that Christmas time, around mid-December, so a little bit
cool.
before
so
Christmas
So I just
time,
did I a whole bunch of holiday parties.
Yeah.
when you're listening to this. And then some just like, you know, luncheon events at companies when they have stuff that for their employees. But as far as places I've traveled, the coolest place I've ever been was probably an island in the middle of the Indian Ocean called Diego Garcia. Hmm. And it's a military island. Mm-hmm. And it's 7 degrees south of the equator. So it's hot.
Right.
And it's just a little tiny island. It has a little runway and it has some like military base. So you can't get there. There's no flights that go there unless you're on official military business.
Mm. Yep.
So you can't like book a flight there. You can't go there at all. So you're only there. There's like military people who are working for the military, like engineers and stuff. And then every once in a while, entertainers
right.
that go entertain the troops. That's pretty much the only way that you can get there. And I went out in it was back in 2012. So it was kind of one of the first big trips that I did after I got started, you know, built up my show for a couple years doing a lot of local things, and then got that one and it was amazing. I got the call. They were like, hey, we're putting this little tour together. You're going out to Diego Garcia for a couple weeks, entertain the troops there. They're like, it's going to be you, a stand-up comedian, and 6 NFL cheerleaders.
Oh, wow.
The cheerleaders fit into the plan because we were going over the Super Bowl. So it was just to bring a little bit of home over to those guys and girls that have been there for, you know, some of the people have been there for 6 months to a year
right.
Without seeing their family. So just right. make them feel a little bit more at home and enjoy the game and watch some tricks and laugh and watch the girls dance and so that was a crazy, you know, that was just amazing. You know, it was like, you know, days of flights, you know, flying
yeah,
all the way around
imagine.
The world and seeing just an amazing thing like that. This year I was on a cruise ship working a couple weeks sailing from West Palm Beach, Florida to the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm.
Back and forth every day. I did that for 2 weeks. That was just about a month or two ago. And just kind of everywhere in between. I've never done like the Europe scene or the Australia, New Zealand scene.
Okay.
But I stick around mostly the United States, but it's often small, weird towns that I would never go to otherwise.
Yeah.
be cool. Like, I would probably have never been to Birmingham, Alabama,
right?
If I didn't do a juggling show there.
Right. Yeah, I've never been. Yeah.
So that's interesting. It's cool. Some of the small towns are really cool. You drive, especially driving through around the United States, especially, you find these little towns that like feel like you go back in time. It's amazing. You see, you're like, wow, this place feels like it hasn't changed. You know, there's like brick. The roads are made out of bricks still, and you're like, wow, this is crazy. And
yeah.
I love that. I love just like finding a new spot. It's like so cool.
Yeah, very, very interesting, and that sounds like I'm Canadian, and I haven't so I know the United States a little bit, but I'm based in London, and there, you know, there's all those parts of the United States that are really really interesting, because I've never been to some of those places. I've never been to many of the states. Certainly Birmingham, Alabama. I've never set foot in Alabama, let alone I've hardly been south of the Mason-Dixon line, to be honest. That's really cool. Very, very interesting. And do people respond to, you know, if we throw away the engineering demographic, do people?
Man, we're really good. Really giving those
away,
guys
but
a
like
hard
if
time.
We just ignore the engineering demographic, you know, I'm very thankful for engineers. Anytime I'm driving over a bridge, particularly, but do people respond to your show in roughly the same way?
Yeah, it's surprising. I was also just thinking another really cool spot that I did was Dene College in Arizona. It's on the Navajo Reservation.
Oh wow!
And amazing. There's a place called Canyon de Shelley there, and it feels almost like I posted photos and people just assume it's a Grand Canyon, but like no one knows what it is. It's like this huge canyon, and it's like, it's on the Navajo reservations. It's not real crowded. You're usually the only person that you can see anywhere around. And that one I was a little bit nervous about, because I was like, I didn't know like what that was. Are they gonna know? You know, I use all pop, modern, high energy music. I'm going to a really isolated place in the middle of the desert in Arizona on the Navajo reservation. Thinking, are they even going to know this music? And, you know, I had no idea. Are they completely disconnected from what the normal pop culture is? I have no idea.
Yeah.
Like what to expect. I was like really ignorant about it. Yeah. And I was like, but then I got there and realized it's just like any other place.
Yeah,
like they're normal Americans.
right.
And I was probably being like I don't know why I was thinking that it was going to be any different, but it ended up being awesome. I was doing a little sound check, and some of the students came in, they were like, whoa, what's going on in here, we love this music. And it was like that was the one thing that I was concerned about, and it like eliminated before I even started the show. They were all excited about something new coming in, because not that many entertainers go through there, so they were so pumped. So what I do typically does universally work for a wide range of audiences, especially wide age ranges, which is what really helps me. I can do like a kids show, and it's pretty good. And then I can also do a full adult show, and it's pretty much the same material. No, I don't need to rely on like doing like dirty material or anything. But it kind of just works for most audiences.
Excellent. Okay, well, that sounds like a very interesting existence, Chris. I'm a little bit I'm curious, because you also wrote a book called Just Go, and I want to understand where that came from, and how it sort of ties in, or maybe it doesn't tie in, with your entertainment work.
Yeah, I think that'll get us right into a good discussion on risk and things.
Great.
As well.
Let's go for
it. Where we probably want to go.
Yeah.
And that was, so I think everyone at some point says, oh, I wish I could write a book about my life or whatever. And I've just experienced so many people entertainers and just it, people in general that say things like that. Oh, mm-hmm. I could, or they see a DJ up on, you know, a big thing and be like, well, I could be that DJ, or a photograph that is in a magazine and be like, I could have taken that photograph with my iPhone. And my response is always the same. It's like, well, what, you know,
why didn't
that
you?
Person did it. Like that person just made a decision to do it. And people often tell the same thing to me, like, oh, I wish I could travel around and not, you know, and do what you're doing. I'm like, well, what's stopping you exactly? Mm-hmm. And people have excuses, of course. And it came down to this thing. I was like, I want to show that there's this possible thing that if you just jump in and do things, you can figure out how to make them work.
Yeah.
And that was what my book Just Go was about, is about just taking that first step and trusting that the following step and the following steps will fall into place. Mm. And we don't need to know. I think what paralyzes most people is we are, going back to you said something about having a blank page, and we see this thing of like a timeline. Say we're on the left-hand side right now. You are here with a big X. We're on the left-hand side of this timeline, and we see where we want to be, and it's all the way on the right-hand side of that. On that timeline, whether that, you know, whether we imagine that to be 5 years, 10 years, or whatever. And when we need to get from that left side to that right side, there's only one way to do it.
Right.
Like, you know, we wish that we could fold the paper in half and just instantly be there, but you can't.
Yeah.
Like, the only way to get there is one little notch on that timeline at a time, whatever that is. But it begins with that first step, whatever it is. And that first step is never talking or thinking about it.
Mm.
It's action.
Yep. I love that. That's, there's a lot of really good, and very deep stuff in what you just said there. And also, from a risk perspective, because, the fact of the matter is, like, so risk management is important, right? And thinking through things is important, and that the act of doing that is incredibly valuable. But you can't account for all risk, and even if you did, risk is, you know, it's an uncertainty that, you know, that could impact whatever it is you're trying to do. So even if there's a chance it might happen, or there's a chance that it won't happen, there's a chance it might, and you don't know until you start to try to do a few things. So, you know, it's important to do that sort of planning, but taking those little steps is even more important. That little bit of experimentation, that sort of deliberate experimentation. So you're going to try this, and if that doesn't work out, I'll circle back and, you know, make an adjustment. And, you know, sooner or later, you start to get closer to where it is you want to go. So there's a lot of really good stuff there. So fully on board with it. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the risk is an interesting word in general, because people can go from so many different sides of it, and risk, the word, kind of makes us feel of this thing of uncertainty, or just that it's almost designed to not work, and people don't want that. So if you tell people like, yeah, risk this, like, people, but you don't want, like, that's, you know, I don't want to risk anything. So and that's where my thing of Just Go, of course, it's not like be reckless and do something that's gonna damage, like, yourself or you know, put you in a position that you don't want to be in. But the thing with it is, and coming from your, like, a risk management perspective, is I don't know if I feel like there could be a better title for that, John. Yeah. I don't know what you think about that as well. That might be interesting to hear your thing of it. But, like, what I've done is is creating a juggling show, that's how I make a living, a quote risky thing to do. Yeah, probably. Mm-hmm. It's definitely not the easiest thing to do to make a living. Mm-hmm. But instead of thinking about it as a risky thing to do, I've just developed my, you know, through building my marketing and my promo material and everything else, I've just figured out a way to make it not risky.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I spend a lot of time making my video look great and my website to look good and people to find me. So do something like jump in. This is rambling now a little bit.
No. This is good stuff.
Get started on this thing and then get, you know, take that first step.
Yep.
And then that next step, it appears, you're like, okay, I know what I need to do. The problem with me, and I know a lot of other people fail at this or struggle with this, is I know exactly what I need to do for that next step, but I like come up with excuses, or I'm like, I don't feel like doing it. And that's the riskiest thing. The riskiest thing isn't taking that first step. The riskiest thing is like being too scared to take the next step when it's presented to you and you know this is what you need to do. And whether it's whatever, like, if you want to be a photographer or something, you don't need to risk that much to build a portfolio to try it. You
know,
you can start with your phone and or, you know, have a part-time job or whatever and buy a camera, go take photos for free. That's not, you know, you're risking a little bit of your time, but if you're really into it and you're excited about it, that's fine. You're not going to lose anything.
There's a lot of great stuff. It's a wonderful analogy. And I like the sort of, you take these little experiments and you think about, well, you know, what's the worst that could happen, right? I don't like it, or I'm not very good at it, or, you know, or whatever. And then you either move on or you adjust, and you just kind of keep going, but you're not going to know until you give it a try.
Yeah. And it's the same as I said earlier, you're never going to know until you try something, and then you will know if you like it or if you don't like it, you can try something else.
Yeah.
With podcasting too, because so many people are now getting into podcasting, and I get people to ask me things all the time, and it's the same. You know, it's tons of people have talked about this before, so I won't go too deep into it. But people ask about, like, oh, what kind of microphone?
Yeah.
And what kind of software do you use to do this?
Yep.
And, you know, while I think it's important to be both sides, as we talked about this earlier, you need to have decent quality. But more important than that, if you're not making it because you're afraid the quality isn't good enough, like, then it's not good quality anyway, because it doesn't exist.
The idea is, like, you're not going to the same thing when I started it. It's, well, I'm going to, you know, buy some decent microphones and kind of figure this out, but I'm not going to drop everything and then suddenly build a home studio, right? and then figure out whether or not it's gonna work, right? So you take these little steps along the way. You know, you start with this kind of microphone, and you do this sort of thing, and that you post the episode and you see how it goes, and you figure out, well, that worked and that didn't, and you just kind of keep going. And, you know, I'm only on episode 29 for my show, and I have lots to learn. But, you know, it's a cool journey. So, that's how it can only work, right?
Yeah, and I go back to my book, and the what was interesting about it was kind of an experiment and a challenge for myself, in that I was like, I want to write this book, and I was like, I know that I don't want to deal with an outside publisher and deal with all of that. I just want to do it for myself, like. I honestly didn't even care if it sold very many copies. I was just like, I need to do this because I've been saying I want to do it for years.
Right, right.
And but my thing was, I don't know how to do it.
Hmm.
How do you organize a book? Do you write the chapter titles first? And different people have different ways of doing this, of course. Do you just start writing and then just edit it down later? I was overwhelmed by thinking, because I am here on the left side of my timeline, and I was looking all the way at the right side of the timeline of, what's this finished book going to look like? And there were too many steps in the middle for me to bridge that gap. I couldn't leap there and be like, cool, this is how I do it. So for that, my first step that was an action step, instead of thinking about that final book, what it's going to look like, what's the theme going to be, what can I do today? This was a thought that I said, what can I do today? And today I can write a blog post and post it on my website.
Yep.
Thinking that that could be, all right, I'll figure out what I want to say today. That's all I can do. I can't write a book today. I know that. But I can write a blog post. So I wrote a blog post. And then 2 days later, I was thinking about something else. That kind of relates back to that thing that I said the other day. I'm going to expand on it. Wrote a blog post. Within 6 months, I had the whole theme of the book written through blog posts. I literally went through my blog posts, copied and pasted them as chapters, went through and adapted it a little bit so it felt more a little bit more like a book instead of a blog. But pretty much it was I kept it pretty true to what it was. And my timeline from thinking I should start writing these blog posts to having the book in my hand, printed, laid out, real book, physical book, was 6 months.
Right, right.
And that was enough time that I could have just been thinking, like, 6 months isn't that long. Not crazy for someone just to sit on an idea and think about it. And I did everything. I was like, you know, I talked to a friend of mine who wrote a book, and they were like, yeah, this lady that does the book layout, it costs like $1,200 or something. You just like basically give her a pile of text and she does all of it. And I was like, I think I can figure it out. And I was like, sure, some people, yeah, that's worth it to just give it to somebody and in a week you have your book done. But I was like, interested in being more hands-on. I was like, okay, for $1,200, I can spend, you know, a decent amount of hours on learning how to do this. Like, you know, a couple days of work, and that's still, you know, it works out to be okay. And so I did it, and I was like, that wasn't that hard, and I just did it all myself. And now it's exactly how I want. You know, I didn't have to be like, oh, you did this thing weird. So it was another thing of like, I can jump in, I can learn this, and just hop on YouTube, and you can learn how to do any of those tutorials for anything. And it was amazing. I literally learned how to lay out a book on YouTube.
There's tons of there's tons of good stuff in there, Chris. I mean, as long as you're not going to YouTube to figure out how to do dental surgery or something like that, then
like, if you're making a book, do that. But
there's a lot of good stuff. I mean, I think when you're starting out in a new venture, it's really important to get your hands dirty, because then you know how everything kind of works and fits together. And I was very much the same way. I'm still very much the same way with this podcast. I do all the editing, I do all the scheduling, I do all of the, you know, I do everything, the production, the promotion, you know, everything's a lot of work because I, you know, I work full time, but through that process, I'm figuring stuff out, and I might not do everything in the future myself, but I know what I want. And lots, you know, I've been listening to a lot of people like you speak, and they say exactly the same thing, that, you know, you do it all yourself and at the beginning, and then you can kind of call the shots more effectively later on.
Yeah. And that's, and it's the only way, you know, to develop your own style and stuff, you know. It's for the YouTube stuff. I think, you know, Casey Neistat, as being the top YouTube vlogger right now, it's like, and he talks about the same thing. He was like, I have to edit my own videos. Like, he can obviously afford to have somebody edit his videos, or he could afford to have somebody walk around with him all day and shoot his videos. But he's like, if this video needs to be my voice, I need to edit it. I need to be the person making it. And there's something of value in that, doing it yourself, of that you're going to create your own style. Then down the road, sure, if you've developed your style, you bring on somebody that can, you know, replicate that and just help you. But my buddy Alex, who's been on my podcast, he's a juggler as well, but he makes YouTube animations. Same thing, he's been doing everything himself for years. Now his YouTube channel is blowing up. If people are into animations, it's his YouTube channel is It's Alex Clark. It's okay. Crazy. He just hit 400,000 subscribers last week. By the time people are listening to this, he'll have 500,000 subscribers on YouTube. And he talks about the same thing. He's like, he needed to create those characters through his animations and build his thing. And now he finally just now brought on somebody to help with some of the, you know, some of the work stuff. But it's so interesting because for people to develop that style, I think we all want someone to help us. And
but it's doing that.
It would be nice.
Yeah.
Get people and you know, starting a podcast, people will grow and evolve with you and be like, cool, I love how this evolved into this. And, you know, that family grows together. So what it all comes down to, I think, is for me going into that same thing, going back to what the book is about, is like it never needs to be exactly where you want it.
Yeah.
You know, there's always going to be, there's that like that Ira Glass quote of the gap between where we are and where we want to be. And that is always going to be there. And that's so essential for that to always be there, because when you do get to that point, I like to think of it as the horizon, or standing on the beach looking out at the horizon. Oh, I got to get there. And of course, as you approach, it pushes further and further away. And that never is going to end. Yeah. And that's a great thing, because if we did get there, we would stop. And that's not good for anything. So it's really great that that gap is there. We get to where we think that we want it to be, and then we're like, oh, now we need to look ahead again and now create a new gap that will never close. You know, just constantly be expanding, hopefully.
Yeah, that there's, again, you know, tons of really good stuff in there. In terms of this concept of just go, do you think that the toughest part is that first step, or is it, do you think, when people encounter their first sort of bits of adversity, or what do you think is the biggest challenge to moving something forward?
Well, for me, I don't know how other people are. I think for most other people, that first step I think for a lot of people, that first step is the hardest.
Hmm.
For me, I'm fine to try stuff. Where I struggle is that first like thing of like, okay, cool, I had this idea, I kind of like manifested it into this thing. Now how do I hit that, you know, you hit that first plateau.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, that was easy, I got here. Then you're like, oh, that was a little bit of, you know, beginner's luck.
Hmm.
Now I need to dig in and like, you know, adapt or figure out something. So for me, it's that first plateau of like, and we get spoiled a lot with whatever that beginner's luck thing is that I think is there's something real about that. Maybe it's just because we're too dumb to like see the challenges at the beginning. So we're just like, yeah, I'm just going to do this and try this. And then it works because we're kind of not looking for the challenges.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm fascinated by this sort of stuff. I'm also fascinated by the progress of, for example, athletes, and you know, the athlete that is the, you know, that's got all this talent, and you know, they move through high school or, you know, college or you know, whatever the progression is in whatever sport. But the some athletes, you just watch their kind of career trajectory, and they, well, as soon as they hit that that first level of adversity, they sort of fold, and it might happen because they've never, you know, sort of been challenged that way, versus other athletes that kind of have always been challenged and kind of push through it. So it's interesting. I'm thinking about, so staying in the United States, and I Tom Brady, for example, as a player who I you know quite admire his path, and I'm not you know I'm a Canadian, so I'm not you know throwing down any allegiances to a particular team or anything, but you know there are a lot of stories, you know, all kinds of athletes that you know the deliberate practice that goes into success. It's really interesting stuff.
Yeah, and I said it earlier, and I think that it's relevant here again, of that biggest challenge for myself, and I think a lot of other people, is knowing what to do, but then actually doing it. And I know that's a challenge for other people, because I've given people advice that I know is good. They say, "Oh, what steps should I take?" I'm like, "Oh, that's easy. Like, all you have to do, like, it's almost there. You did all the hard work to build this product or whatever it is, this show or whatever it is. Now it's like, you just need to do this one little thing to connect it with the audience." And so many, especially artists, but I think people in general, it's like they're expecting it to be hard, or they're expecting it to not work. So then that fulfills itself in that.
Interesting.
And there's a thing that I kind of have an issue with, and it's this: people that they call themselves, struggling or a starving artist, or I think there's a, I don't remember if it was in the book or if it's, I like, after I wrote the book, I had to be like, I can't look at this anymore. But I like had read it so many times. Yeah, so yeah. Now I'm like, was it in the book, or was it a blog post after the book came out, about this thing of like, people call themselves I live in Los Angeles, so that everyone is an aspiring actor or aspiring director. And I have a major issue with that word in general. And it's because I could say I'm an aspiring author, or I could write a book. And I could say I'm an aspiring director, or I could take out my iPhone and make YouTube videos every day. And sure, maybe you're not a big Hollywood star, but it's like these YouTube people are getting more views
than the big Hollywood stars.
Yeah. And if you ask, there was something out. Somebody did this thing where they asked like middle schoolers who the top
I heard about this
stars, like, who are the A-list, who are the biggest celebrities in the world. You ask like a 34-year-old, and we're still going to hit George Clooney, Leonardo DiCaprio, Johnny Depp, and you ask middle schoolers. And these like A-list celebrities, quote, don't even make it into the top anything. Yeah. It's all social media stars and YouTube people and people that don't have any training, or and they're filming shaky videos on cell phones.
Yeah,
so
that's super fascinating. Yeah.
So what's more important, like trying to fit into this old thing of like, I'm aspiring to be this. I'm like, no, just go do it.
Yeah.
Like,
go
make a video today, or go make a podcast today, or go write a movie today and figure it out, because.
Yeah. And your first movie or your first podcast or whatever isn't going to be perfect, but you start the process and you're honing that craft. And, you know, the more that you do it, the better it'll get. So, versus waiting for all the parts to align and then you're going to do it, right? Or waiting for, I guess in Hollywood, it's all about catching that big break. I guess the people still talk about that, but when I get cast in this thing, then everything will be different. Everything will be great. So it's a different world, isn't it?
Yeah. Chase Jarvis, who is a big league photographer, and he said something about going back to the risk thing. It used to be, you wanted to catch your big break. You move to Hollywood, you go to auditions every day, but and you play that game. It would be really risky to start your own thing and just start your own show or whatever. How would that ever work? Even 10 years ago, 15 years ago, how would that ever work? Like, what's the distribution? He says now, the riskier thing is to play the old game and go sit at auditions all day when you could be out creating your own content. I know there's a balance there. It's like I go to auditions and stuff as well, and there's a balance there. So it doesn't need to be this like one track thing, but I think it's good to diversify that of like, if you want to be going to auditions, great. But you could be making a video about going to auditions every day.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, because the barriers to entry have come down so much through technology, right? So it's very low risk to get started on this sort of stuff, right? You can just do it, versus, 15 years ago, you'd have to get your own film crew and your, you know, cameras and all that stuff. And that's not the case anymore. So the risk equation is really, as you say, it's really flipped. So you might as well just get started.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, a couple $100 and I think you can start pretty much anything you want.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So in terms of I'm curious, you know, you're an entertainer, you're an author, you're a podcaster. I'm curious how do you view fame and success? What does that look like to you?
That's a great question. I've done so many podcasts and no one has ever touched on that. which is great. That's an interesting one. And I think that word, as the example of what an A-list celebrity, that the word of fame is changing so much. I know I'm getting more into trying to get into the YouTube scene.
Mm-hmm.
And what's so interesting about that is there's people who are getting a million views a day.
Yeah, that's
that. Yeah. No one has ever heard of,
that's right.
Quote, yeah. No one has ever heard of.
Yeah.
They can walk down the street and go to the grocery store and they're fine, but they're getting more views than, you know, Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah.
Every day. And, that's what I, you know, as far as fame, I would just like to have like a core audience of people who keep coming back. Like my buddy Alex is the same way. He can walk down the street and no one's people aren't bothering him or harassing him, but he's getting about 1.5 million views on his YouTube channel a week. So he's not at the huge level yet.
Still pretty good.
That's like what he does all day is make YouTube videos. He's getting, you know, about 5 million views a month, which again goes back to being like what some major television shows get as far as viewership. And it's so amazing to see that he has these fans and people send him fan mail. And when he does do an appearance, people come out and line up for his autograph. And, you know, he doesn't – this thing of, like, the A-list, B-list thing is, I think, really going away as we don't have – our entertainment doesn't come from ABC and NBC and CBS, where there's three to four stars. Now our entertainment comes from one of 10 million YouTube channels. And, you know, it doesn't – you don't – going back to that, the barrier of entry is open. So I post videos that get 100 views and I'm like, wow, that wasn't very good. But then I'll see somebody, like somebody that I know at a show, be like, oh, that video was awesome. I'm like, wow, I never would have had this chance in the old system. If I didn't have like a huge viewership, I would just get canceled and they would be like, screw you, you're done. And then no one would have seen the work that I would have been doing. So what's great about this is like more than like the fame success thing of what we see. I think it's just like having this core audience. If you have 100 fans, same with podcasts, like most podcasts get less than 100 listens.
Yeah,
per
exactly. Yeah.
Thing. I think there's a stat also on Spotify or something. It was like 99% of all the songs on Spotify have less than 100 plays.
I believe that. Yeah.
And that was like a real number, like because they can track that. And I'm sure it's the same. I'm sure even more of podcasts, 99.9% of all podcasts out have less than 100 listens.
Yeah.
And that could be, I think that could be discouraging
it
for some
be,
people. But also for me, I'm like, if I get, you know, my podcast doesn't have a huge listenership or anything, but if I get like a couple hundred, I'm like, wow, well, I don't know a couple hundred people.
Exactly.
Like I can't text a couple hundred people right now and say like, hey, listen to this. So I'm like, somebody that I don't know clicked on this and listened to this. And I'm like, that's amazing. Or the other side of it is, if you have a YouTube channel or if people have YouTube channels, you can go look in your analytics and see how many minutes people watched for your for that month. Mm. And that's more interesting to me because I'll have videos that don't have very many plays or something. I'll start to get discouraged by it. And then I'll go, look, how many minutes did people watch my stuff this month? And it'll be like thousands.
Mm.
And I'm like, that's real time, like real human experience that could have been used anywhere. And there's thousands of minutes that people were experiencing what I created.
Yeah. I think there's some really interesting stuff in there. I mean, first of all, 100 people, like if you think about 100 people in a room, that's a lot of people in a room, right?
Yeah.
And if you just, you know, you put one video or one podcast up a week and 100 people listen to it, that's, you're connecting with those 100 people. Just by doing that from your, you know, from your laptop, you couldn't have done that before. And I guess the other thing is that there's this, I don't know if you've heard of the book The Long Tail.
Yeah.
So it's basically that, you know, if there's an audience for everything. So if you started a show or a YouTube channel about, I don't know, people that like to skydive and knit at the same time, I bet you there's a group of 100 people in the world that are into that, right? And if you can find those people and start doing a podcast about it, then they'll, you know, that audience will grow for you, or will become, maybe not grow, but be very, very loyal. And there's the other concept of the signal and the noise. So I don't know if you heard of the book The Signal and the Noise, but there's all this in the world, there's all this noise out there. And signal is, you know, something that's meaningful. But for, you know, for the people that are into, you know, your stuff, well, it's not noise, it's signal. And it might be a small group of people, but, you know, that's very powerful to reach those people. So, and you know, the flip side, I think, is if you have millions of viewers or followers, well, what is it there, you know, that they're attracted to? And, you know, are you going to be able to sustain that? Or is it going to be very fickle, right? So it's hard to tell. I think there's a lot more to what's going on in the world of social media than I think we know on the surface.
Yeah, totally. And those numbers are relative to what it is. You know, a skydiving knitting audience of 100, which is loyal, is a whole different than like some dumb prank video or something gets 10 million views.
Yeah,
but they're gone. You know, that doesn't mean anything because that's not a real following. And going back, the audience for anything reminded me of Gary Vaynerchuk, which everyone will know. Of course, the one video that is real, I think, greatest, one of his really nice videos, came out within the past year. One of his things on his YouTube channel was just, one is greater than zero. So one fan, if you have one fan that watches your videos, which I think it's pretty hard to post a YouTube video. I think you have to try really hard to post a video and have it actually get zero views. Like you're going to get a few.
Yes.
And even if that number is one, if you didn't post that video, that number was zero.
Yeah.
If you do, it's going to be one or more, and one is greater than zero.
Yeah.
And, you know, he is an example of what he did that with. You know, he talks about Wine Library TV. He just did it, and he kept doing it. He was like, we're getting – there's the stats of that. You can go look at the stats of those videos. They were getting a couple hundred views.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept doing it because he knew he needed to keep doing it. Now he's like – now he's getting, you know, thousands and millions of views on everything he does.
Yeah, that's you know, that's proves certainly proves the point. And I think on the flip side as well, I see a lot of this. I don't know what's the right term for it, but I'm going to call it inauthentic authenticity. So there's a lot of copycatting of stuff, right? Of, you know, Casey Neistat's videos or of, you know, whoever, and that might work for a little while to learn your craft, but you know, at the end of the day, you're going to have to find your own voice. So there's, you know, there's a lot of that going on as well, which, I don't think is sustainable in the long run, whatever it is you're trying to do, whoever it is you're trying to connect with.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like Casey Neistat is the biggest because no one did things like he did when he started doing these videos, you know, years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
He developed that style. Now that's what a YouTube vlog looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure he was getting, you know, 30 or 50 views or however many. It wasn't what it is now. So it's just, as you say, it's, you know, you start with just go and you just keep going, right? And sooner or later, you'll get to whatever that horizon is.
Yeah. Yeah, I know we didn't talk too much in that risk thing, but as I was looking at some of the stuff that you usually talk about, I kind of wanted to push it away from away from the idea of risk, because I said earlier, this idea of risk is, people don't like that. People don't want that. So and I know your objective is to inspire people to jump in and do things.
Yeah, and to think about it in a different way, that, you know, we have to take risk in our lives, because that's what makes life worth living, right? If everything was entirely predictable and we knew what the ending and the outcomes of whatever it is we're trying to do, then that would make for a boring but B, you know, a very unmeaningful existence. And I think subtly, and sometimes very overtly, you know, the messages we get are, you know, don't take risk, you know, don't do this, don't, you know, be very mindful of risk, and that's not how we should be approaching it. So it's, you know, everything that you talked about fits right into that. It's important to start to, you know, to take chances and just, you know, experiment, and as you say, just go with it, just go. I know we covered a lot of stuff, Chris. Is there anything that we haven't touched on that you'd like to mention or you'd like to dive into?
I think that was cool. I came in not sure where we were going to go with it, and we hit some cool stuff. I think I like that. I like the free flow of it. But just as, if people want to reach out to me, I know people
where
are working on
out?
Things
yep.
or have questions about even the technical stuff. I know I don't. Uh-huh. I say the technical stuff doesn't matter, but it is important. You know, as far as like, how did you make the book work on Amazon or something? If people have questions about specifics or stuff, stuff like that, always down to help. So if people want to find me or send me a message, you can find me pretty much anywhere. The easiest place is my website, which is chrisruggiero.com, which that site is designed to sell my juggling show.
Right.
But if you go to the contact form, it'll say about like booking a show, but like those emails come to me. Like, don't send it to my agent, like my agent's phone number and stuff is there. Don't send them questions about how to make a book.
Right.
Send that directly to me.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, Chris, I really enjoyed this. This was a blast. So, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Yeah, that was really cool. Thanks for having me.
I hope you guys enjoyed that. As always, check out the show notes to find out more about Chris, his website, his book, as well as the different links to the things that we talked about during the conversation. Now, I'm spending some time working on the lineup of guests for the show, and I want to get a good balance of people that can cover big picture type conversations, so similar to the ones that I've had with Mark Blythe or Daniel Wagner, as well as conversations with people who've taken some risks, done some interesting things, people like Laura Bingham, Laura Del Fara, Luke Tybursky, Taryn Kent Hume, and I want to hear your views, so I'd love to hear your thoughts on the show, what episodes you like, and if you have some thoughts on what or who you'd like to hear, let me know. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. We will be back with another full episode in 2 weeks' time. I may come back with an in-between episode next week, but we'd certainly be back in 2 weeks' time covering a completely different topic to the one that we covered today. And I hope that you subscribe. Go to allthingsrisk.co.uk. That's the best place to subscribe to the show or find all the ways that you can subscribe on the app of your choice. And we will be back. So until then, don't forget, risk is life.